So I'm just here,
I've recorded
it
apparently.
Possibly maybe connect with anybody locally who might want to share or see if I can help in any way.
That sounds great. Thank you so much. Sure. And I know Brian, so I know we're... Go ahead, Carol.
Shay has seen the good, the bad, Shay has seen the good, the bad, and especially the ugly of IEPs.
Very good. Well, let's just dive into IEPs. I'll do a really quick foundation, and then, but I'll put, be pulling in COVID types of issues as well. So just before you even get an IEP, you have to be eligible. And that seems really easy, you would think. But unfortunately, it isn't always. A lot of districts try to put a child, especially a child that has any functional vision, sometimes even totally blind kids, they try to put that child on a 504 plan. I've just heard about it this week. And I don't get it because districts lose money when they do that. But what they do what they do. So eligibility for an IEP for visual impairment, including blindness, that's the legal term, is actually a much, much lower bar than it is for specific learning disability or some other disabilities. It's a three-pronged process. The child must have a visual impairment. Now, in the past, states have said, oh, well, you have to be at least 20/100 or 20/70, can't have, your vision can't be better than that. That's completely illegal. There is no acuity threshold. In the past, states have had field loss guidelines that you must have this much field loss to be considered for an IEP. Completely illegal. So all of that is completely illegal. All you have to have is a visual impairment. And frankly, that includes monocular vision, only one useful eye. That includes binocular dysfunction, convergence insufficiencies, which are actually ocular motor. They're not eye issues as much as they are motor issues, but it's part of the visual system. That's considered a visual impairment. Even color blindness is. So visual impairment is really wide open. Now the second prong is a little, is what narrows it. By reason of that visual impairment or visual impairments, the child is having adverse educational effects. But the big point to remember here is the adverse educational impact must be without any modifications at all, because the educational impact is using regular education. So we're using regular print. Child's reading it at a typical reading distance, no special lighting, no visors, no magnifiers, just straight on. When we're looking at other types of educational impacts, perhaps art class, or a big one often is PE, physical education class, child has to be able to do it without any adverse impact. So that is, and that actually includes even social types of things like walking in line, going through the cafeteria. If the visual impairment is adversely impacting those activities, then we move on to the third prong of eligibility by reason thereof, need special education or related services. That's a fairly easy one to do. Even with color blindness, people might say, oh, well, we can just modify a few things. Yes, you can, except there are issues in the world, and the child does need some education to figure out how to get over the color blindness issues. And we probably do need to have some accommodations when we're looking at science and math, social studies maths, science graphics and such, because they're very heavy on color. So even what we might consider a mild visual impairment can qualify a child for an IEP. And I shouldn't have to go on about this, but just this week, like I said, I found out about a child in New Jersey who's a Braille, he's getting Braille instructional services, uses a white cane, who's on a 504 plan. And the district doesn't want to give a child an IEP, or provide, I should say give, provide the child an IEP. So unfortunately, that's still a problem. There are, we have legal resources backing up what I said. There's a something called Dear Colleague Letter from the Department of, United States Department of Education that clarifies what I just said. So we have backup if you need it. Don't worry about that. At the IEP, there are certain things that must be done. We must have, first, the parent needs to be invited. And parent needs to have a reasonable opportunity to attend. If parent really cannot attend during the school day, it's a little different probably now with COVID, maybe. But maybe the parent is a nurse or a firefighter and can't just, isn't working from home. So the school needs to make reasonable accommodations for that. School needs to make it inclusive for the parent. And that includes doing it after hours. I love telling this story. It's one of my favorites. Oh, there is a family, not mine. This I heard from the special ed director who was actually doing things right. The family identified as vampires. I'm not kidding. And they wouldn't go out at night. Or wouldn't go out at day, I'm sorry. So their IEP meetings were held like 9 or 10 p.m. because they're vampires. And the district did it for them, so that was just kind of remarkable, and I love it. But so districts need to make IEP meetings available for parents during hours that are convenient for the parents as well. Also, we have to have the right people at the IEP team, at the meeting. We have to have a parent, if at all possible. A regular education teacher, unless the child never interacts with a regular education teacher. And that's very rare, especially nowadays. The art teacher, the PE teacher, the librarian, they are regular education teachers. So if the child is interacting with them in a classroom type, like in a library class, then that at least one of those types of people need to be there. Special education teacher, and anyone who is a service provider who's, what their service may be changing, they need to be there, or there need to be some written excusals for that, and ideally they would be there. Please note that you have a right to get the reports that will be discussed at the IEP ahead of time. I always ask the schools to give me three business days. That 5 days or 3 business days, your choice. And I didn't always get it, but after a while, they actually started calling me and saying, you know what, we're not going to be able to get this to you in time. Let's reschedule the meeting. Because you need time to look over it and digest it. And at the meeting, with a room full of people, is not that time. If they don't get it to you in time, they say, gosh, I really want to attend, but you know what? I asked you for this. You knew it was important to me. I really need it. And you have that right. You don't have the right legally in New Jersey, but you have the right to meaningfully participate on the federal level. And if you give them sufficient notice, that is important. You also, the most important person from your point of view, from the school side, though, is the LEA representative, local education agency representative. That would be your principal, assistant principal, special ed director, assistant special ed director, even superintendent. It is not the librarian. It is usually not the guidance counselor. Those people don't have administrative privileges, and if the school is trying to get by with that, you can definitely ask for, and I would in writing, that this guidance counselor has the right to bind the district. The reason is, at the end of the IEP meeting, we want to have an IEP that an individualized education plan that's valid, it's enforceable. And the only way we can do that is if the school has somebody there who can legally bind the school to this contract. And that's what the LEA representative is. So it's very, otherwise, and this happens a lot, the school doesn't send a true LEA rep. And then at the end, they say, oh, well, I can't really sign it. We'll ask the superintendent or the special ed director to look over it. had a meeting that's worthless. And that's wasting your time and everybody's time is there. You definitely want somebody who can make those decisions. If during the meeting, the person identified as an LEA rep, well, I'm not sure if we can do that, that's a big red flag. And it's reasonable to say, okay, from my understanding, the LEA representative can bind the district and has to know what the district's resources are. And frankly, that's the federal law. You can say it really politely, but this is my understanding. Would it, maybe we should postpone this meeting until you know what the resources are. In a kind way, saying that, because it is a waste of your time, and it's very unfair of them to do that. At every IEP meeting for one of our children, everyone, there are every IEP meeting for every child, actually, there are five special considerations that need to be addressed. Is this part of the child? And is the child's blind or visually impaired? And for our children, that should be yes. If that's true, that child should automatically get Braille, Braille use and Braille instruction. That's the presumption. The only thing that can overturn that presumption is an IEP team. The whole IEP team has to determine that based on an assessment of current and future reading and writing needs, that Braille is not appropriate for the child. We heard Debbie Bloomer during the journal session, she did such a great job. She's absolutely right. Audio is not reading, and audio is not writing. They are great supplements, but they are not reading and writing. And as she said, first grader is struggling to read that already quite in large print. It's almost certain that Braille is appropriate for that child. The child does not need to need Braille to survive. Braille is a given. And I describe it as we can only withhold Braille if we, as a team, decide, based on an accurate assessment of current reading and writing needs and future reading and writing needs, that Braille isn't appropriate. When we talk about future reading and writing needs, there are two things to consider. A lot of times schools only look at one. Schools often only look at, is the visual impairment a progressive condition? Do we set the child to lose more vision? That's not the only factor. That's one factor. Other factor is what we expect from the child in future years. The child is going to get smaller print. Kindergarten, we have about 24 to 36 point font. In high school, it's usually 10 to 12. But it's really small. And we expect a ton more volume. Kindergarten, you're reading just a few words per page, on a page. And in high school, obviously, it's many, many words on a page. So those two factors, the physiological future for the child, what we can determine, but also the educational need that we already met for the child. Nowadays, with our COVID, we are adding in one more, screen time. And that probably won't change even if we have a cure for COVID tomorrow. Online learning, it will not go away, especially here in the Northeast where we have snow days. I'm guessing we probably won't have snow days in the future because you could just have an online day. So screen time is another factor to consider with that real consideration. There is also a Dear Colleague letter on that, and we'll be happy to help provide that. The other special considerations are deaf, hard of hearing, behavioral, that behavior that adversely impacts the child's learning or others' learning, English language learner, and assistive technology. We tend to talk about accessible assistive technology or just access technology, and I really encourage you to talk about accessible assistive technology because, number one, it needs to be accessible for our students, and by accessible, I mean our students need to be able to use it in an effective and efficient manner, just as effective and efficiently as sighted kids can do it. So that means our children need the assistive technology and the assistive technology services thinking about that. What do we expect from sighted children? They are flipping all over iPads or tablets in preschool, and certainly in kindergarten, first, second grade, a lot of them. Our children need to know voiceover commands simply so they can keep up. But our children also need refreshable Braille to accommodate that lack of screen access. So, yes, I'm saying for a 3 or 4 year old, or certainly for a 5 year old in kindergarten, if the school is providing iPads, even just in-class use of iPads for educational games, where you have little letters and numbers bouncing across the screen and words, then our students need voiceover commands, need to have mastered those, and need to be able to use as independently as we can think of a refreshable Braille display for that iPad access. When we're talking about laptop computers, sighted kids use a mouse, click all around, and again, they have all that wonderful information on the screen. Our children need to learn touch typing skills, typing without looking at your fingers, as well as keyboard commands for Word, for Windows, for email, and absolutely for a screen reader. I like JAWS. It's very robust. You can get it. The school can get it. It's not that big a deal. And it's just so, so valuable. So that's what I would recommend for a student. And yes, at 5 or 6, when the other kids are using a mouse, our kids need to be able to use the computer, and they need to be able to use that computer efficiently and effectively, and that's going to be with JAWS likely, and the foundational skills before JAWS, and the refreshable Braille display, so they can access that information on the monitor. So I will say one thing about behavior. Be really careful, because sometimes they will blame behaviors on a child when they are not providing appropriate accommodations. They'll say, oh, he's inattentive, she doesn't work very hard. Well, if the child can't see something, then they're going to be inattentive. They're children anyway, so they're going to be inattentive. So we need to have really good information about the accommodations provided before we start labeling a child behavior-wise. For an IEP, you need present levels. The present levels are the foundation of every IEP, and they need to be good. We need to look at academic achievement on a grade level, not, well, doing okay, considering you can't see anything. We don't consider anything like that. The IEP is to get the pre-appropriate public education is designed to allow the student with this disability to fully access the regular education curriculum. So we don't have any considerations. We don't have, well, for a blind kid doing okay. We don't have any of that. You have to provide the accommodations to get there. And if we're not, then we need to know why. And that's where our academic achievement comes in and our functional achievement comes in. We do have to be careful, though, because we can have some really bright kids who are kind of making do early on. And passing grades do not mean that a child does not need Braille. If a child is passing with large print, but if Braille is still appropriate for the child, then Braille is still appropriate for the child, because it's not really great to force a child to use something inefficient for years. And then once the child starts not being able to use it because of fatigue or deteriorating vision, say, oh, here's something brand new to learn that we should have taught you 6 years ago, but we didn't. So let's start now when you're in sixth grade and on the edge of teenage years where you just love doing something that nobody else is doing. You love having everything different from every other kid. Of course not. Let's provide it when we should, as early as possible, so that you learn it and you use it, and then you don't have that wall that you hit in elementary, middle, or high school. We also, present levels, have progress on goals. If we're not making progress on a goal, there's a problem. And it could be the goal's a problem, could be the instruction's a problem, but there's a problem, and we just have the same goal every year is never a good idea. It's always a concern. We need to discuss why the goal is the same if we don't, we're not progressing on it. And present levels also includes challenging behaviors, daily living skills, and but it kind of boils down to strengths and needs. Strengths need to be real. Enjoys its learning new things. That's a real strength. It has a pleasant personality. It's not a real strength. It's motivated by dinosaurs and race cars. I don't mind that as a strength because that tells me as a teacher what how I can really help motivate the student. But that's the kind of thing. We want the strengths to be something that are actually useful from an instructional point of view. And I shouldn't have to say this, but I see it all the time in IEPs. Use of residual vision as a strength. It's not a strength. If a child is getting an IEP under visual impairment and blindness, their vision's not a strength. So that is not. Needs, well, lack of vision is a need. And it is important, though, I think, to share with the team that the needs our children have with regard to access to the curriculum are not the child's needs, but they're really the result of the failure of the school to provide accessible materials from the beginning. If schools provided Braille from the beginning, which they could, there's nothing they provide prep from the beginning, they absolutely could provide Braille from the beginning, then the child wouldn't need Braille because it's already there. If the schools used accessible software from the beginning, then the child wouldn't need accessible software because it's already there. So if the schools had their teachers make documents and curricula in accessible format, then that wouldn't be a need because it would already be there. So I just think it's important for the team to understand that they are not being put to more work because of the child. They're being put to more work because they don't typically do that. But this is work that they could and frankly mine should do, but they choose not to, and there are consequences to our choices. So that's okay, but this child needs this. And I do try to get in all of my IEPs that the blind student will receive access to curriculum materials, classroom posters, bulletin boards in the hall, everything, really, and the sighted kids get at the same time or earlier as when it's provided to others. And that often freaks them out. Well, I might not know what I'm doing till the night before, so how could I provide it to the Braillist in time? Well, then you may have to change the way you prepare your materials. You may have to change your procedures. The teacher may have to do things with a little more lead time, or the school may have to give the Braillist more hours or something to do things. Whatever it is, the point isn't that it's changing the school's processes. The point is that the child needs it. And my little mantra is, if it's good enough for the sighted kids, it's good enough for the blind kids. So anything that's important enough to create for sighted children is also important enough to create for blind children. And of course, when I say blind, I'm using the NFB definition, very broad, when vision is not efficient and effective for you. Some COVID things to think about with regard to assessments, present levels, and instruction. We hear, oh, well, we can't do that via distance. They can. We can do Braille instruction via distance. We can do Nemacode instruction via distance. We can do accessible assistive technology instruction via distance, and we can do orientation and mobility instruction via distance. It can be done. Really, about the only thing I think couldn't be done, from a distance, if I had a parent there to help with some of the measurements, some of the functional vision assessment couldn't be done. I couldn't do an eye chart. Very well without parental help. I couldn't do how far is it till the child, excuse me, not here. My blind child didn't know I was on a meeting. I apologize. But the Provincial Official Assessment, frankly, from my point of view, isn't that helpful in a lot of ways, because I don't try to maximize children's vision. I try to maximize children. So I don't want to see how tiny print I can, or how much I can force them to read large print. I want them to have the Braille if they need it all, because that's the law. And then we can play with the print. That's not a big deal. One big thing I see as an issue is Zoom rooms. Zoom is wonderful because it's accessible, but as I'm sure many people on this call know, when people add to the chat, you hear it, and it's very hard to pay attention if there's a lot of chatting. I have one student I'm working with who is in an algebra class, and the teacher allows all the students are silenced during class, but the chat just runs the whole time. My student isn't getting much out of the algebra class because there's so much chatting. But that's a COVID thing we have to think about, and we've come up with some ideas about some solutions for it, but we're not sure which way we're going to go on it. But our kids have to have access, and the sighted kids are not hearing that chat all the time while they're trying to listen to the teacher. So our blind kids shouldn't have to do that either. With regard to materials, I am a big proponent of getting an embosser in the home, if at all possible. It's good to note that right now, American Printing House for the Blind, where the school can use some federal money to pay for materials, does have embossers available in those federal funds right now. That's pretty new, it's pretty exciting. And it's really pretty reasonable because sighted kids can go most anywhere to print something out, even if they don't have a printer at home. Our kids can't. And it is important to read hard copy, print, or Braille. So that's one little nugget I hope to help with. And then for folks who are looking for something new, I hope that's a new nugget for you. And another nugget I'm going to promote the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children. We have a partnership right now with, I hope it lasts forever, with Freedom Scientific, wherein if you join our organization as a TWIG level member, that's very high level, and you can ask Joe about what TWIG means, because he's a TWIG medal winner, and so is Carol. Carol can tell you too. For $12, you will get a free year-long license of Freedom Scientific software, JAWS, a robust and screen reader that in its new release has some really cool things. I'll talk about that in a second. The JAWS or Fusion or Zoom Text. Zoom Text is a screen magnifying software. Fusion, yeah, I'm going to use these. JAWS, Fusion, Zoom Text. Fusion is both JAWS and Zoom Text. So what that means, I don't recommend anybody get just Zoom Text unless you really don't have that much vision impairment, and if you do, kind of why are you using it? Maybe if you have some kind of visual processing issue that you want white letters on black or something, that might be. But in general, I would say if you have functional vision that you use, get Fusion. Because it comes with full Zoom Text with full JAWS. It's not just a partial, it's full. And even if you're not using JAWS now, it's a great screen reader and it's a really good idea to learn. It's another tool in the toolbox. If you don't have functional vision or you, like my blind child, hates Zoom Text, get JAWS. Usually, the regular prices, Zoom Text for a year is $80. JAWS is $90, Fusion is $160. Right now, you can get any of them for $12 for a home license. So please consider that, and I will post that into the chat when we're not chat talking. And I know that Joe and Carol can share that information as well. Okay, wow. Well, we have some time for questions. We started late. Are there any questions, concerns, ideas? Shay. I see a hand up, Shay. Oops. I think I asked you unmute as you had unmuted, Shay. There you go.
Hi.
Hi.
So it's funny, we've experienced everything you're talking about. And it's right, but we shouldn't have had the Holly Miller in. I've just invented a poem, okay? And he just got his first braille in September. But my real question is this. Because I have a big concern about this, and I had the peripheral. I was like, what's that all about? Why are you making him see tiny print? How is that helping him? All of it. And it's definitely been met with resistance, or the agency, well, this program's too hard, or try this free program that's full of ads. So I learned one thing, and then I'll ask my question. What I learned is, if we get the technology first, they seem to address it like, oh, well, you know, it becomes a good idea. It's still not a however, I'll do what I need to do until we can resolve that, which leads me to, like, how do we make it so that if you have to Holly Miller it, how can we make that tool available to parents who can't afford it? That's why Opinion 56 was so important. As well, I don't think we knew that Braille was required from day one, and we got it at year 10. They got our kids pretty extraordinary. He taught himself abacus, and you know, he's doing very well with the Braille now. And I digress. There was a thing. Should I be concerned? Because I noticed that the new teacher who hasn't met him in person yet keeps talking about, oh, he can use his multiplication chart in his accommodations. He can use a calculator. I said, and I didn't argue with her. I said, you're not doing that because that's not in your accommodations. You know your multiplication table. But what he needed was his abacus. Or if the math problem was a word problem and it wasn't multiplication, he could ask Siri what a bigger number was. So can you talk to and about the difference between modifications and accommodations? Because one, it's very detrimental in my opinion. And then once they're set, I can't change a word of that IEP anymore. I haven't signed one in years.
Yeah, well, actually, you're legally allowed to. So let me just first address that part. You can call an IEP meeting under the law. You could call one a day. I don't recommend it. I don't recommend calling one a week. You might, if you're having real trouble, you may have to be one a month for a couple of months. But you really can call a new IEP meeting every day. Just don't do it because it will make you crazy and won't help you in the long run. Yes, you can change modifications and accommodations. I'm going to jump back to something you said earlier, and then I'm going to come back to your accommodations modification question. We were talking about getting technology. When you get technology first, then they start to accept it later. And that's one of the strategies. If you get technology, like if you get JAWS or Fusion, start taking notes. Take the data that they refuse to take. Show how it's making your son more efficient, or it's allowing him to be less stressed after his homework. Maybe it takes the same amount of time, but he is feeling more confident. Have him write up about how, when I had that web quest in social studies and I could get to the websites better and I could tell that the blank website wasn't accessible and I was really confident in that because I had my JAWS. That kind of thing is great for the IEP. Should the school be doing that? Of course they should. Of course they should. But if they're not, you can do it. But you and your son, students have the right to be in the IEP meeting from three years old on. So the student always has the right to be there. So if your child needs to talk about some things and to share information, the child doesn't have to be there the entire lesson, their entire meeting. But it can be very impactful to have a child come in and speak about a couple of things that are better with a specific technology or with the abacus or something. Now, to accommodations versus modifications, it's a great question. Accommodations are not changing the content, not changing what is being taught or asked of the student. So an example of an accommodation for a crossword problem would be to have the list of clues, and actually the crossword, it is a little bit of a modification. Accommodation would be with a 20 problem homework set to provide the 20 homework problems in Braille. And that's an accommodation. It's the same thing. To provide tactile graphics of the graphics. So we're not changing the reading of the coordinate axis, but we are providing it in a method that the child can access. The abacus is an accommodation. It is not changing that the child is doing the calculation, because the child is using the abacus, and the abacus is not a calculator. It's a pen and pencil and paper. The abacus, you can't just type something into it and make it work like a calculator. It's not a calculator. So a calculator is a modification, because the calculator does some of the content function for the student. A modification for a crossword puzzle, and actually this modification makes it harder for the blind student, to get the clues and then have how many letters are in each clue. That makes it harder because on typical crosswords, and I like crosswords, and I tell you, as a print reader, I use the clues. If I get one word down, that gives me letters in other words. And when my blind child got crosswords at school, Anna only got how many letters it was. So Anna didn't get that clue. It was actually modified, but it was modified harder. Okay. When they had word finds, I personally find word finds, I like them, okay, but I find them not instructionally useful for Braille readers, although I know people like to use them in Braille, and that's fine. If it's recreational, I have no problem with it. If it's not recreational, it just has no educational value. Instead, we had Anna get the list of words and write a meaningful sentence with each word. That was definitely modifying. Modifying down would be only 10 of the math problems. Or using a calculator on the math problem, except when other people aren't using a calculator on the math problem. Now, if everybody's using a calculator on the math problem, so that's that, then we're talking about an accommodation to have an accessible calculator. So, does that help?
It does help, and it is my understanding. While you were talking, I also recalled that it's also grouped together in our IEP, modifications and accommodations. Now, we found a way we're going to work with it, because we're definitely at a different level of
diplomatic
way. However, I think it's useful for maybe if there's any new parents. I don't see a whole lot of new names here, but I definitely think that is very important, because yes, you can change the IEP. Yes, you can call a meeting at any time. However, it's often met it's such a delicate situation to communicate. It's simply, it becomes delicate, and I find that now that it's there, I had been spending more time saying, oh no, we'd like to remove this so-called accommodation or this or certain things, because now with the tools that we've been working on, he is incredibly much, he's very independent. He's doing all his work himself. He's not dragging around a Visio book because it doesn't work for him.
Right.
Or the other thing I want to share with your parents is you have all the power. If you don't want the device, give it back. He was using a Chromebook that was smaller. The screen was smaller than the computers the sighted children were using in school. And that hasn't even landed anywhere. Like that. So I returned it.
Right.
And I found a TV screen and plugged in an HDMI cord. And all of a sudden, everybody thinks that's such an amazing thing, and I'm like,
you know, I don't know if you can see me, but I'm touching my head, like, yes. My head, oh my goodness, I could have had a V8. What you're saying is, I think, incredibly important to any parent new to the process, because I'm finding it very difficult to make an accommodation, you know, make a modification and accommodation in minor group together.
But it matters what it is. I mean, they are grouped together, but if it's changing the curriculum or changing the content, it's really different. Some tools that might help you. Number one, you can refuse any offered accommodation modification. And number two, there should not be accommodations and modifications, especially for high stakes testing, and which would include out-of-school testing like SAT and ACT. If the child is not regularly using the accommodation, you're not supposed to use it on high stakes tests. So you could pull that into the IEP. Well, yeah, you're saying this, but it's not being used. And I'm really concerned about how that might impact the college board accepting accommodations. So that might be a little way to twist it. If he's not using the accommodation and is succeeding without, or he's not using the modification, it shouldn't be there. And that can be a data thing too. Our present levels are, if he's not using the calculator, he's using Abacus. But again, if all the children are using the calculator, and there are parts of these high stakes tests where you do need a calculator, then he needs to be using it too. On that note, the TI-84 was used for a long time. It is no longer available from APH. It is available from some other places, but even the SAT, as it's moving toward digital tests, which are hopefully accessible because it's certainly worked for my blind child, but that's not true. And it looks like they are because they are making some intelligent moves toward that. They are actually including the Desmos, S-M-O-S, online calculator, and it is accessible. It's a scientific calculator, and College Board is actually starting to embed Desmos into the test for all students. Yay! Another big plus about this, well, a big warning, iPads. Can't use iPads on SAT, and there are a lot of blind children who are even in middle school and high school who are forced to just use iPads. iPads are not robust. I'm not a fan of iPads as the sole tool. iPads can be okay for as an augmentative tool, but not as a sole tool. And I'm also not a big fan of Chromebooks. You can make them work, but you're not going to be able to use JAWS on it. And more than 90% of blind people in employment who are employed use JAWS. So it's not a great plan for future employment.
I'm clear. I noticed that my son advocated for himself recently that they online, they were taking a short vocabulary test, and they said, you know, go into the other room, we'll be reading the test. And they decided who needed the test to be read to them. And my son said exactly what you said. He said that, you know, I can't concentrate with all this talking. I said, well, honey, make a request. And, you know, they said, oh, okay, you know, and he went back in the other room and took the test with the rest of the class silently and got 100%. And that was a big part of his frustration, was people sort of doing stuff to and for him. So with the, you know, I don't recall, accommodations also maybe is something to be aware of, these like general statements. For example, as needed. I find that they're always, it's like my son's vision is someone else's inconvenience. So,
right. Yeah,
well,
no.
These general statements.
Right, no, I mean, they need to be much broader. One thing I don't mind is assistance when requested by the child, but again, we want to make sure the child is getting, is independent enough and to not be requesting it all the time, because modifications are fine when needed, but when they're needed is typically if we are transitioning from one transition into a new skill. So we need to support the child as the child is transitioning to that skill. We don't just throw you in the pool in the deep end. As we're teaching you to swim, we're probably going to start shallow in, and then you're going to move to the deep end. And that's where modifications and support are really helpful. But once you're swimming independently, forcing you to start at the shallow end is not helpful. Are there any other questions? My time's up. Are there any other questions?
Actually, this is Max because I'm at the host, so I can't raise my hand. Sorry.
Sure.
So I'm actually an adaptive technology specialist here in New Jersey, and I'm actually glad that you mentioned Desmos, because I find it with a lot of students, they get recommended the TI-84 plus calculator, and they even have troubles memorizing the keyboard, the keys and stuff, because they can't see the keys like all the other students. Like, obviously it speaks, but it doesn't help you if you get it on the scene. So actually, I've been recommending Desmos for those students to use, so that's what I would use too. So.
Yeah, one word of caution, there are a lot of math teachers, and it kills me because I love math. They teach the TI-84 and they teach drugs. It's almost like route training. They don't teach you what you need to know to do the problem. You hit this button and that button and this button and that button. And it's like memorized route. So parents might run into some of that pushback from a math teacher, but you could even say, I don't want my child to memorize keystrokes. I want my child to know the math.
Yeah. Well, what I've also done is, like, I've supplemented, I said, I recommend the Desmos, but then, like, I've suggested you can download the TI-84 application, so the buttons are read to you before you put them in. You know?
Yeah.
And I have to say, Asian is wonderful also.
I'd like to say thank you so much, Carlton, for that very informative presentation. If any other parents or adults or anyone, students on this call, have questions, Carlton, would you give out your email or some way to contact you?
Yes, I have the quick membership information in the chat. I'm going to put that in the chat, and then I'll put my email in the chat. So
do you mind saying it out loud, because we are recording the meeting?
Sure. It's Carlton Walker, and I am at NOPECPRES@gmail.com, and that's N, National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, NOPBC, PRES for President, PRES, @gmail.com. Chat now.
Thank you very much, and on behalf of all the others, I'll give you a round of applause. That was great. Thank you so much. I could listen to you all day. I'd like to take a moment now before I begin my part of the presentation to ask Julie Deaton to say hello. Julie is the national rep from the National Federation of the Blind, who is here at our state convention give us national report. Julie, would you say a few words to those on the call?
Thank you, Carol. And you know, I agree with you. I could listen to Carlton forever, because I am so passionate about making sure that kids are getting what they need in school. And I feel like it just takes so much education. And I think it's really difficult for parents often to advocate on their own. And that's why we have the NFB, because we're here to help all of you. You know, it's easy to just talk about IEPs and everything, but you're in the midst of a meeting with your child, 20 people sitting around, and they're talking to you about this is the way it needs to be, this is how it should be. it's really overwhelming. I know that I dealt with that with my son, who is not blind, but he has a learning disability. And when he was in school, I have to say, I felt very overwhelmed. And I'm just so passionate about it, too, as a blind child growing up, to have the, you know, I was able to learn Braille as a child, even though I had some vision. It really wasn't going to be effective for me. Determined pretty early on, which was kind of unusual at that time in a sense. Well, it still is too often, I'd say. But I learned Braille from the very beginning, and I love to read so much. And as I stated in my report on yesterday, I feel like there's so many blind kids that are taught Braille still. And we have got to change that. And I see them as adults when they come to the center, or as teenagers when they're in our summer programs, and they don't have great literacy skills at all. And so, you know, it's exciting to be working with everybody in the NFB on it. And then I also just wanted to mention, here in Colorado, we've been assisting a parent with an IEP in the last couple weeks. And that parent, there's been a couple meetings now, and they are saying to her that they cannot provide virtual training to her blind child, that truly the only way that it's going to work is to do face-to-face training, and she doesn't feel right now that it's safe to do that training. So we're in the midst of a bit of a battle right now with that situation, because it's just, they cannot dictate that when all the other kids are having virtual training, and she feels that that's the safest way to go right now. So there might be others that end up dealing with those sorts of things too. So there's always a lot going on. And I love Carlton talking about people saying, you know, not having their Braille because the Braillist, you know, they get the assignment the night before and the Braillist might not be available. And I'm very old school, but I remember my itinerant teacher, Mrs. Gump, with her Braille writer, brailing away. They didn't have Braillists when I was a kid, and they didn't have computers either. So she took the Perkins Braille writer and brailed all of my assignments and my worksheets. And that's why we also want to make sure, you know, in the NFB that we can groom dedicated teachers of blind kids, because we just so need it. So I'll stop talking. You could tell I could go on and on about all kinds of things in this area. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you, Julie. And I don't think I mentioned to everyone that Julie is the director of the Colorado Center for the Blind. So if you have any questions about the Colorado Center, Julie, I'm sure will be very happy to answer them. Okay, so our next topic is social skills. And some people are just born naturally good at this. And some kids lose assistance in getting there. And probably if you're at this session, you have one that needs a little assistance, or you work with someone who needs a little assistance. So I'm going to kind of go through the overview of how social skills develop in children, but mostly in blind children. The social development really starts when the child is a baby. You might read in professional books about blindness that your child doesn't make eye contact, and so everything's all messed up. But in reality, vision isn't the first important sense that gets developed. It's certainly skin-to-skin, tactile. So don't you worry if your blind child doesn't look at you. That doesn't matter at all. You can express all the love, and they can receive all the love and give it back without eyesight. Not an issue. A blind baby needs the very same developmental experiences as any other baby. So that would include sounds and movement and exploration and the social interaction. So one of the keys with a blind kid is to get them used to sounds and noise from the get-go. I met a lot of parents who are concerned because their babies seem to startle so much, or they get upset when there's noise. So if you have a child who's, you know, sensorily sensitive like that, you can take it slow, and you can maybe reach out to someone trained in sensory integration to get some ideas on how you can use massage and other techniques to get the child more tolerant of sound and also movement and anything else he or she might be too sensitive to. So some of the sounds and noise you want a child to be able to not just tolerate but enjoy are voices of other people, including other children, laughter, household sounds. And if your child is really reacting badly, like really having sensitivity issues and you're worried about him or her, try, in addition to sensory integration, try looking up Lily Nielsen. She has a lot of wonderful sensory toys that can get a child more centered and get the child to be where he or she needs to be in order to take in the sensory input in order to develop. The child needs regular developmental experience than any baby gets, say, movement and exploration. What we're aiming for is called purposeful, self-initiated movement. Purposeful meaning the child decides they want to do something. Even babies make decisions like that. Self-initiated means the child does it, not an adult. We don't roll the baby over, the baby rolls over. Now, we can help the baby roll over, we can give therapy to help the baby roll over if there are motor issues, but what we're aiming for is self-initiated. We want to draw a blind baby into the world. I think if there's any area that can be challenging for a blind child's development, it is that sighted kids have a constant barrage of interesting things to look at. So if you have a blind child who isn't so much interested in the world, you want to think about how you can accommodate for the fact that there's no visual interest out there. So what can you do that with a blind child? Obviously, sounds, vibrations, tactile things, fragrances, lots of ways to try to fill in that gap so that your blind child becomes interested in the world. We want them to think about, like, what's in the world and what can I do with it? Those are things that get a baby to move. Now, the baby's not conscious of moving at the time. They're not conscious of their development. But what they're really doing is discovering and making movements and doing actions, and that is really what we call play. As the child becomes a toddler, movement and exploration bring them even more into the world as they start crawling and then walking. And we want them to find out also who is in the world, what's in the world and who is in the world. And you can start to play games like Find Mommy, or Find Fido, or Find the Music Box. And usually you can do that with sound. What got my daughter finally moving was we would crinkle the bag of her favorite crunchy snack from across the room. And that got her finally to move. Nothing like food. And so once we're finding what's in the world and who's in the world, it leads to the next important step, which is the social interaction. Social interaction gets language going, and that leads to communication. And language and communication and movement lead to a knowledge base, which I'm starting to have an understanding of what's out there. And the communication and ability to express themselves leads to getting their emotions under control and eventually it leads to self-help skills from the very, very beginning. It also, of course, leads to the ability to interact with others and being able to interact calmly and pleasantly and happily with people other than the basic caregivers, mom, dad, grandma, whoever it might be, will lead to preparation for playing with other kids and going to school. I want to say a few words about play, really important. We're looking for purposeful, developmental play. Play is, you've often probably heard, play is the work of children. I like to say play is the learning of little children. It's discovery of things and it's action. So they find out what happens. Well, let me see if I touch this. What happens if I touch this? What happens if I bang on this? So maybe they see they're sitting in a high chair and they inadvertently move their hand and they bang. And then they like that sound. So now they're banging on purpose. And suddenly we have the purposeful action. So believe it or not, banging on that table, and maybe once they bang on their, I don't know, their bowl or something after they turn it upside down. And they see the difference in the sound. And guess what? That's discovery. And that's part of learning. It's really how little children learn. So they see what happens if you bang on something, if you push on something. What kind of sounds they can make. And you'll watch babies, once they do something that they like the effect, they'll keep doing it again and again and again. And I think that they repeat their experiment, just like a little scientist. They really think they're like little scientists. They're finding out what happened. And they keep doing it until they sucked all the juice out. So they've gotten all the learning they're going to get out of doing that action, and they'll go on to another action. One thing we have to watch out for is overly repetitive action. So repeating their experiments is good, that's leading to learning, but overly repetitive actions is not good. It's not moving forward and learning. It's kind of being stuck in a blank space. Sometimes it seems like it's mindless. I've seen kids sometimes, they'll take a truck in their hand, they'll turn the truck upside down, and they'll just spin them. And they'll spend a long time just spinning those wheels with their hand. That's not really such a good thing for a development. So you have to kind of look carefully and see what's really going on. So if you find the kid is really doing a lot of repetitive play like that, or maybe they're developing repetitive mannerisms that don't look so good, maybe flapping the front of their eyes, or doing sort of a certain kind of like tensing their muscles and shuddering and tensing their muscles. So they may have reasons, physical reasons to do that, and you should look for that and address those reasons. And a lot of times physical and occupational therapists work with that. If the child needs some release, you can do suggestions for that. But if they're just habits, or if they're just sort of self-comforting habits, you probably want to try giving them something better to do. Because if the child develops habits like that, when they get to school, if they're still doing them, it's going to impede social relationship. And if they get to adulthood and they're still doing it, it's going to impede the ability to have friends, get a job. So it's, I think, worth the effort to try to tamp those down, give the child something that to do that is enjoyable, but also moving them forward. As the child becomes a preschooler, we want to be thinking about imaginative play. Now, again, some kids just do this automatically. I had a kid who didn't. I really had to teach her how to play imaginatively, how to pretend. And for us, the first time Serena pretended, She was lying on the floor. I think her brother and her and she were rolling around on the living room. And I came in, and they were right near the sofa, and I was planning to sit on the sofa. So I sat down gently on Serena, and I said, oh, this is such a comfortable sofa. And she thought that was his dad. And that was the first time Serena ever pretended. And then I was the sofa, and they sat on me, and they were the sofa, and I sat on them. And it was the first time, but it lit the spark, and she was able to do that afterwards. So we would pretend to be animal family. I was the mom and the dog, and we're the puppies, or whatever it might be. Then we started acting out stories that they knew. And so in our case, I had to intervene to get to that developmental step. So I think a lot of being a parent of a blind kid is looking at the big picture and seeing if there are any spots the child is stuck. I know many of us, probably the majority from statistics I've read, have kids who are not only blind or visually impaired, but have some sort of additional developmental or some sort of other disability going on. So it may not be the blindness that's causing it, but maybe there's some co-disability. So I think if we're really good watchers, observers of our child, we can intervene, or we can get help for someone to intervene when we notice that something isn't developing smoothly. When our kids begin playing with others, all the regular stuff applies. They have to get used to sharing and taking turns and not taking things out of somebody's hands. Again, though, sometimes our kids get stuck and they're not doing that playing with others. So sometimes we have to facilitate a little more with role modeling, maybe with an adult or older child helping with the two children, so that the blind kid gets a little coaching on the way. If your child has only a non-standard way of playing with a toy, for example, the truck that I mentioned before, the only way that child plays with the truck is by holding it upside down and making wheels turn in his hand, try really hard to teach the standard way of playing too, so that the child won't have trouble when other kids are around. We want to encourage the children, and sometimes we have to actually teach them, to enjoy another child's company. I feel like there are a lot of reasons for this, especially for kids who have additional stuff going on, as my family, our daughter, did when she was young. We had more than our share of doctor's office visits and visits to therapists between 1 and 3 years old, when other children are not having those, and they're out there already developing. And I feel like sometimes our kids are a little bit behind because of that kind of situation. Don't let that get you down. Just start wherever you are and go to the next step. Give your child the experience of this. One of the things that probably most children have to learn, not just blind kids, is how to react in various situations. Like when two little kids are playing, what to do when you feel annoyed. Well, you shouldn't pick the block up and chuck it at the kid's head, the other kid who annoyed you. Not a good way to proceed. That was the first thing that happened to my son, the first kid he played with in kindergarten. I guess John annoyed him. It picked up a block and just hit him right in the head with it. So we have to teach our children appropriate ways to express annoyance so that their social skills, their social interactions will be successful. And we also have to teach them what to expect if we annoy somebody else. What can you expect? Yeah, you might get a brick chucked at your head. But we have to give them the realization that there are social cues out there, and that we can guide them to beginning to pick up on those social cues. As the child gets older, one of the things for especially a completely blind kid is recognizing and responding to an invitation to play. So maybe it's more visual, and so we want our children to know about all the things kids might do when they're actually inviting you to play with them. And, you know, the general sort of behaving as a regular kid. The tone they use when they talk, the words they use, laughing at appropriate times, knowing some games, knowing some jokes, doing some movies, just sort of trying to be as up on things as you would want any of your children to be. So I know families have all different values about these things, but let's just say if your child, if your blind child were sighted, however you would want them to be in this kind of world of kid games and movies and videos and stuff like that, that's what you would want to aim at for your blind child too. You want them to be ready for various social situations. And I just listed a few pretty usual ones, not during COVID, but others than COVID time. The classroom, recess, lunch room, supermarket, doctor's office. Maybe you take them to work with you, birthday party, and the kids over for going to somewhere. Hopefully we will be back to that sort of more activities soon. Part of this is developing the child's personality. And one approach to developing personality is you want the child to have something to talk about, something that would be interesting to another child, to a peer. We grown-ups, we will humor little children, and they can talk to us about everything. We'll pretend to be interested. And then what did you do? But believe me, a peer won't do that. So you really want the child to learn how to interact with peers. So how do you develop personality? Well, do your best to give the child a big bite, you know, expand their world, so take them to places and build their knowledge base. And try to observe what other kids that age are doing. And maybe you can give your child those experiences too, just sort of guide them as well as you can. Because if you can do this, this gives the child knowledge of things and the ability to talk about them. One big one is social awareness. This is a really pretty gigantic subject. I'm just going to touch the surface of it right now. But like the others, if you would like to talk to me more about this at another time, I would be most happy to talk about it. But here's some thoughts on social awareness. A person needs to figure out what's going on somebody's day. What did the person mean? What did the person mean? Maybe they didn't mean exactly what those words said. And how to respond to what the person meant. It means understanding someone else's state of mind. That's kind of like sympathy and empathy, trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes and think about it through their brain, see it through their eyes. It's developing flexibility. It's learning that you might want something really badly, but somebody else might want the exact opposite thing. So we want our children to develop flexibility. If the game that's going to be played is not the one that they want to play, they have to learn how to go along with the flow. And then maybe introduce the game that they want and a little later. I think a really important one is for our kids to be aware of social convention. Social convention, that means things like, you know, what is considered by society to be appropriate for various situations. I know this varies all over the country, et cetera, but whatever's in your area, in your large family and friend group. I used to tell my kids, though, you can wear those really dirty clothes again, but people may not want to come near you. So if you choose to do what society kind of says, nah, we don't do that, there could be this consequence. I think it's just really important when kids are in high school and they want to wear some really rude t-shirt. Maybe you're going to say, okay, you can wear that t-shirt, but just be aware you're going to get disapproval from a lot of adults. You may offend people, and people may not, you know, they may not want to talk to you when you're wearing that kind of shirt. So just so our kids, we're not telling them, no, you can't do it. You can't flaunt rules. We just want them to be aware that if you flaunt rules, there are consequences. There are social conventions for conversation that I think are really important for our blind kids to learn, like facing the other person. Even if you can't see them, face them. It means a lot to sighted people. An appropriate tone of voice, appropriate volume, taking turns in conversation. A big one, appropriate amount of time to talk. I've heard that described as the amount of braille that would fit on an index card. And that probably is roughly good for handwriting too, before you give somebody else a turn. The timing of comments, that can be hard in a group for a blind person to know exactly when to chime in. But I've seen people be very possible to get really good at this. You have to learn to be a good listener, put all that social awareness to use. Things like personal space. I've heard a really handy one that if you put your arms at your side and bend your arm at the elbow so that your fingers are facing out in front of you, if you are close enough to touch somebody, you're too close. And that can be just like a easy way for your child to check when they're still learning and they can't tell by voice how far away they are yet. Postures, when our kids need to stand up straight, keep their heads up. We want to teach relaxed postures. A lot of times our kids are a little stiff. Now, again, I don't think this comes from blindness. I know in my daughter's case, it came from her whole motor issues that she had when she was young. And I know I've met a lot of kids who were also dealing with motor issues. But her tendency was to sit up really stiff and straight and extremely symmetrical. So I wanted her to learn how to look casual, how to, you know, put her elbow up on the table and lean her face on her hand, how to put two elbows on the table, maybe clasp her hands, maybe to sit side saddle with her arm over the back of the chair. When she was young, I used to watch the other kids in her classroom, occasionally follow the teacher around the room, and if the teacher would turn, the kids would all turn sideways, you know. So these are things that all help your child to look like, again, I'm going to say in quotes, a regular kid. If your child does have mannerisms like pressing their eye or flapping or rocking their heads or whatever it might be, you could develop a secret signal that can be done from across the room where you don't have to say their name, you don't have to say so-and-so, stop blanking. You don't have to draw any attention to it, but your child can hear it. And this was, I got this idea from Ruby Riles. So she used to use a snap. You could put your hand even behind your back and do a snap. Your child can be alert to it and remember to stand up straight or whatever it might be. Take their hand out of their eye. It could be even a click of your tongue like that, or clear your throat. No one would even notice that you're doing it, but your child can pay attention to it. And we don't really want the world to feel free to tell their child, oh, pick your head up, all their peers, all their teachers. I don't think that's good for for the child's social development or self-image. For conversation, I think you need to teach your child to be interested, as interested in what others are saying, and interesting, so that others are happy to speak with them. They need to learn how to take turns, like how much to talk in any turn, not dominate the situation, and how to further the conversation rather than changing the subject to their favorite subject. We don't want our children to be saying, I don't know, talking about their umbrella or something, and that's the only thing they can or want to talk about. It's really good if children learn the effect they're having on others, including how to tell if you're boring somebody. This is not just for blind people. I've met my share of boring people. I try not to be boring. But we can teach our kids that if they're getting the bare minimum of response and they're just getting a little, and then the first opportunity, the person walks away, that's probably means the conversation didn't go so well. And so you can give them some, you can discuss it, and you can model and practice, and you can help them learn other ways to respond that would be better for social interaction. Get to, I think, the really exciting part. Let's say you've done that, kids do pretty well, they know how to have a conversation, they're pretty good, a friend or two, they know how to play. Now we're getting up to pre-adolescence and teen years. And I saw this quote a couple of nights ago. And I'll say, the goal is for us to bring up a person who is, and here's the quote, independent in thought and vigorous in action. I read that in a novel that I was reading, and I thought it was really good. Independent in thought and vigorous in action. That gives me the image of an individual, a real individual. And a leaf blower has started up in my neighborhood. Is it too noisy? Would you raise your hand if it's too noisy? I can move my computer to another room. Okay, looks like it's okay. All right, so a great way to bring our children up to be independent in thought and vigorous in action is to bring them up with a problem-solving approach to life. I think if we bring up, it's good, but it's particularly good for blind kids because the world isn't made, as Carlton was alluding before, it's not made an inclusive world with all the stuff accessible. And you can bet there's always going to be problems to solve. And as all of you adults know, that's not just for blind people. But if they are brought up, so what does a problem-solving approach to life look like? Okay, so they're frustrated. They can't make something work. They can't do it, whatever. They don't know how. So you teach them to think, how can I do this? How can I problem solve? We parents get really, really good at teaching our children how to do things, showing them how, we get to be experts at this. But at some point, we really have this teaching and showing, and we take that step back and we say, you problem solve this. You think about this, figure it out. And you watch them and you see if they can figure it out. And if they're completely flummoxed and they have no idea how to do it, then you guide them. But guide them with a teaching point of view, a teaching approach, so that you're not just telling them what to do or showing them or teaching them how to do it. You're teaching them how to figure out how to do it. I can't tell you how important this is. You're gonna hear why in a few minutes. Most of the time they're going to be able to figure something out, or you ask them to think out loud, you can hear how they're thinking, and you teach them how to think about it. How did you figure it out? Well, you can even guide them through the way a person might think about it. So what if they're thinking and thinking, they really can't figure out a way to do it? So then you want to teach them how to use their blindness network. They don't even know they have a blindness network, maybe. But what is their blindness network? Well, it's the National Federation of Blind. It's the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children. It's their teacher of the blind. It's the rehab people if they're older. It's social media. They can go ask people online. And there's YouTube. someone mentioned in another meeting that you can go on YouTube and find out, Carly before mentioned about O&M, you can go on YouTube and find out pretty much how to do anything. That includes blindness stuff. There's some just wonderful blindness teaching stuff out there. Terrible stuff also, but there's some wonderful stuff. So if your kid grows up and feels like they're ready for the challenges ahead, just think about how that's going to make them look. They're going to look capable. They're going to look confident. They're going to feel capable and confident. And I think they will have self-respect, and they will have the respect of others. So I wrote in my notes, please pay attention to this part. I hope you're paying attention to the notes too. So you have your, now let's say, teen or young adult. You really want them to have a sense of responsibility. You want them to be able to take initiative. You want them to be self-motivated. Now, I know all the parents of teens are rolling their eyes and saying, come on, they're teenagers. Well, yes, they are, but we still need to get this message through. We must get this message through. It's really important. They need to have time management skills, and that includes being organized, knowing how to prioritize, knowing how to develop a goal. Really important under developing a goal, they need to know how to plan realistic steps to meet that goal. I like to think about them showing leadership at home. Yeah, even at home. They can think about what needs to be done at this age. So I think developing leadership ability at home, you can do by developing their thinking skills that we were talking about before, problem solving, etc. Ask them what they think and get their feedback on things, on, I don't know, a movie you watched or a book they read or different things, events, anything, social interactions. Get them thinking and, get them, let them know you value what they think. And their opinion. And I know, especially with teenagers, often we have to sort of try to steer the conversation so that their opinions get maybe a little closer to what we would like them to have. But I think it's really important for us to hear what they're thinking and show that we have respect for the fact that they're thinking. And while we're at it, while we're showing them respect for their opinions, we can teach them to have respect for the opinions of others. We want them to have this self-awareness that we were talking about before. How are they doing? How are they presenting themselves? How are they being received by others? Make sure you teach them how to speak in more than one-word answers or grunts. I know a lot of teenagers do that with their parents, but make sure they know how to speak in a whole sentence with somebody else. And we want their attitude to be, again, they can be surly and awful at home. I hope I wasn't. But we have to make sure that their real attitude underneath is they know that they can do things, they know they're a part of society, they know that they can contribute. And we want them to be able to express that in a tone of voice that is acceptable to other people. Now, why did I go through that whole last part from when I said pay attention? Because this is how you get and keep a job. When your kid is young, it's all about school. When they get to be a senior, it's all about college. They get through college, they fall off a cliff. And I don't want your kids to fall off. There are real, they call them soft job skills, that our children need to have in order to get a job. And I'm just going to run over that list real quick again. Sense of responsibility, ability to take initiative, self-motivation, time management, prioritizing, developing goals, showing leadership, being self-aware, being able to interact with others. That's really the soft skills of job And I want you all to end up with a capable kid who lives and works and plays well with others. And that is the end of my presentation. And if there are any questions, or if anyone would like to discuss anything,
I just want to say what an excellent presentation that was, and it is so true. I mean, there's so much to think about and great parenting skills to have, whether your child is blind or not. But it is true, you know, as blind kids, we do need to be told a lot more because we don't observe things in the same way. And I still remember as a little girl growing up, and I'd have dresses on, and my mom would say, Julie, you need to sit with your legs together, because I just didn't know that. I just didn't know, you know? And I always remembered it, of course, the minute she told me, I remembered. I thought, oh, yeah, I guess I do. But on top of that, you know, we see so many of our students who come to the Colorado Center as adults, and they haven't really, they've gotten their families, they kind of have an art at, their parents have told them, given them some information all along, because they want them to be independent, but they give them information all the time about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a young lady right now at the center, and she has another disability as well, but she definitely knows where everything's located at the center. She's been there now for a month, and she knows where things are really pretty well. But she continually asks all the time, can you tell me where is this? Where is this? Where is this? And if one person won't give her the answer, she'll just go to the next person and ask them. And, you know, we're really working with her on saying, you know, I told her just the other day, I know you know where that is. You tell me. And she was exactly able to tell me where it was. So I think just to encourage parents to, it's okay if your kids make a mistake. It's okay if your child gets turned around. It's okay if, you know, you don't need to, you know, worry about letting them know everything. And that it's hard for a parent to do that, but I think down the line, so that they can have really good problem-solving skills. You talked a lot about that too, Carol, in your presentation. I just think it's really important. And one thing that I always remember from Ruby Riles too is age-appropriate. So if your six-year-old can pour a glass of milk, then you want your blind six-year-old to pour that glass of milk too. As we get adults that come to this center that are 20 years old, and they've maybe never poured a glass of milk.
And I know, Julie, nobody in all these years, no one ever said to me to do that. And when I finally figured it out, I was like, wow, this is really important. And it's important for everyone. We shouldn't be so passive, you know. And anyway, so, yeah, I thank you for your compliment, and I agree it's really important.
Juroflow? Thank you, Carlton. Thank you, Carol. As always, I learned so much. I think I dozed for a little bit, and I apologize for that. But I was wide awake after that. I was wide awake. So anyway, I apologize for dozing for a bit. I'm on this medicine, and sometimes I just conk out. So anyway, I'm wide awake now. Oh, watch out. So thank you very much. I'm going to go over to the other Zoom channel and see you guys there later. Good luck. Take care. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay, so any other questions about IEPs or social skills or, you know, anything else you want to talk about in our couple of minutes? I think we have till 3 in this room.
Hey, Carol.
Shay, I see your hand is up. Go ahead.
Ma'am. I just want to share, because I know that we listen to professionals, and you, to me, are one of the most esteemed in this field. And when I last heard you speak, it was about independence, and it was about somebody came over to teach your daughter how to make French toast, or how to teach a blind person to use a stove. And I'm proud to say that it is ridiculously easy to teach age-appropriate skills, but I took that very seriously. But I just wanted to share as somebody who was actively working on those things, that they're very beneficial, and that, it can be daunting sometimes if you're hearing stuff for the first time, and go at your own pace, but this child is, can use the stove. I take the food out, but he knows how to use it cold. He has his braille buttons. I don't know what they're really called, but we put the buttons on the microwave. And I've seen him come alive because he's incorporating all those brain functions. Like, why is metal, why do we only put certain things in the microwave? And then we start talking about metal, and it's a conductor, and we have a whole science lesson, and all sorts of things. And so I guess I'm saying this because I'm so grateful for what it is that you provide and what you put together. And it's in a book. So the whole thing about telling, kids, maybe you want to chew with your mouth closed, or nobody wants to look at that, or you're the bearer of the bad information. And my son's like, okay, yeah, I'd rather have it be you. You're right, Mom. I'm like, well, Carol's right. This mythical creature named Carol, because he doesn't remember.
He's going to think I'm the devil incarnate, giving him so much trouble.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask, if Carlton is still on, Joe?
I am.
Hi.
Hi.
Joe mentioned a document that somebody, I suspect it's you, put together. He said it was very useful. Something about the top questions at IEP meetings and great answers for when you get a no sort of document. Are you familiar with that? Anyone? If so, can we get a link to that?
Would that be the pop-up IEP stuff, Carlton, maybe?
It could. I'm not sure. The pop-up IEP is kind of old. It's actually not even online anymore. Not exactly sure, but maybe we could work toward creating something like that.
Yeah, and we can ask Joe, or you can ask Joe and see what it was. I missed that myself before, so.
It was on Wednesday's call, and he sent it to me.
Okay.
But I thought it might be more useful for people who weren't me.
Good, yes. Please, would you take the initiative to go and find out from Joe what it is and share it with us?
Yes. I'll throw my arms in the air in a gesture of course.
I gave the thumbs up.
Thumb two. Go. Okay. Because apparently it has the legal definition of why no isn't the answer. Like it says, well, it says right here an idea that ABC.
Yeah.
It says right here in faith that XYZ. So, thank you.
Okay. Anyone else have a comment or a question? All right, so I think we'll bring the official meeting to a close. It's 2:54. I believe, please someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we continue at 3:00 in the other Zoom room, the NFB regular Zoom room. Is that correct?
That's what I
was. Mac, you said yes, it is correct?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right.
So thank you so much. I love this.
If anybody, does anyone on this call need the link to the other room, or are we all set? Okay, looks like we're all set. All right, thanks.